Hi, I'm Suzanne Redmond. Welcome to The Left Brain Artist. Today, my interview is with artist Stephanie Lee. Stephanie is a painting and jewelry artist who has a long history of teaching incredibly interesting classes. She has taught many live workshops as well as online classes through her websites and others. I've actually taken many classes with her. You'll notice in our interview that I go off topic a bit when I pull out the necklace I made in one of her classes to show her. I can do this because when I interview my guests, I do it through Skype and we can see each other when we're talking. She manages to get us back on track, but that's what you get when you have a bit of friendly history with someone. I've always felt a kinship to her because she lives in an area of Oregon where my mom and all her ancestors are from. I feel like I can picture the area where she lives as I've visited there a few times. I had loads of fun talking with Stephanie. She's always so generous in her classes, so it was no surprise that we'd have a warm and fun conversation. This is Stephanie Lee. So welcome, Stephanie. It's nice to see you and hear from you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've known Stephanie for a few years, and yet we've only met in person once. So I did take a live class with her, jewelry making, out at a retreat in Portland quite a few years ago. But since then, I've taken a few of your online classes. But I want to go backwards first before we talk about that and find out, when did you start making art? Have you always been an artist?
That's always such a hard question for me to answer, because I always had access to things that could be built with or made with. I always had access to, you know, craft supplies, or my dad's garage always had wood and tools in it. And my parents were pretty keen on teaching us crafts. I remember not being able to read the cross stitch pattern that my mom was teaching me how to do. I was relying on the pictures of it, you know, so I was young enough that I couldn't read it yet, but I was doing the craft of it.
That's
and
great.
Crochet, you know, just like a lot of handiwork stuff, way when I was young. And then when I was like, I'm going to say like 10, my dad and mom had divorced. And so my dad was a single dad, and I would be at home alone from, you know, school to when he got home, and he had taught me how to use the bandsaw. And so I would be bored out of my mind. So I would go out there at like 10 years old, 10, 11 years old, and I would like cut my name out of wood with a bandsaw and, you know, nail something together and spray paint it and be like, look what I made while you were gone, Dad, you know? And he was always so like, wow, that's fabulous. And then he would try to teach me like the logistics of how to make a thing be sturdy, or, you know, like whatever it was I was building.
Right.
So I've always been a maker of things. One of my first moments of like, wow, I want to be someone who makes things. Mm-hmm. Like I made that connection, was in like my church group when I was a kid, like our youth group. We had a drive-in movie night one summer, and we were supposed to make cardboard box cars. So it was like a fake drive-in movie, but we drove our box cars to it, like, right? So we'd all sit in our boxes that we had turned into cars.
That's
and
great.
I won for the best car, and I had like your container headlights or something. And I just remember thinking, wow, this is like making things is a thing.
Or so, maybe you realize, oh, I'm getting praise and accolades, and that's
sure. I'm sure that was part of it. But it was also like recognizing that that there's validity to it, that even an adult can recognize if a kid has been creative about something, you know?
Yeah.
And then I think my curiosity just kept me looking at other materials and mediums. And it was interesting. I had a friend, just the other day from high school comment. I mean, I graduated in 95, so it's been a long time, but she said, I remember riding on the bus with you and you telling me that you wanted to be an artist when you grew up. And it was baffling to me, because I don't remember thinking that in high school. I don't remember feeling that in high school. I don't remember having it as a goal or ambition.
I think that is so awesome, though. That's so great.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, cool. Well, it just goes to show you that you can have this like idea or this ambition or this endeavor that you're working towards, and then you can like go off-roading in life for a little bit and get totally off track on, and then somehow it just finds you again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, so. I think it sounds like you had a lot of encouragement from your parents, from school, and that goes a long way for people doing things. You know,
yeah.
I mean, not many 10-year-olds get to use the bandsaw alone, but your dad taught you how to do it and
yeah.
he trusted you, and you were creative enough to really want to do it instead.
Yeah.
I don't know. You could have gone the other direction and say, oh, that's hard work. Oh, that's work.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Well, you know, one other really cool thing that my parents did, and I should like tell them personally thank you, because I'm just now kind of realizing it, is they both were very encouraging of not only what I was making, but of my kooky vision or my desire to, you know, like it wasn't necessarily that I was making something great and they were like, wow, that's beautiful. Cause sometimes it wasn't, you know, but they were always encouraging of my efforts and endeavors. And I always felt that.
That's
and they
great.
Were also really, they were also really good at helping me understand the value of getting better at something, like improving a skill, mastery.
Right.
You know,
like what you said, when your dad would come home and see what you did and let's make it sturdier or let's make it 3D or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And they did it in such a way that I never felt like they were looking at my work as not good enough and they were fixing it. It was always just like I remember, crocheting this like strip of stitches and my mom was like, wow, your stitches are so even. And she wasn't, even in that moment, she wasn't teaching me, but she was showing me how to see things too. And she would, you know, she was teaching me, okay, if you put your needle up here, then it's easier to get the right length of stitch or, you know, just kind of these, ways of helping me understand the value of getting, you know, being good at it. Like it wasn't just wild, unbridled creative mess. It was that, but then also, do you want this to be, straight? If so, here's how to get it straight. If you don't care, cool. You know,
yeah.
So I really appreciate that now, you know, as an artist very much.
Yeah. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Where was it that you grew up?
Utah.
Utah. Okay.
So you're central Utah, south of Salt Lake a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And so when you moved on from high school, did you go on to college? Did you take art classes when you were in college as well?
Actually, I had plans to go to college.
Okay.
I was accepted at a couple colleges. I was going to go to college for botany.
Okay.
I was just absolutely in love with the plant kingdom. And I came up to Oregon for the summer and never left and never went back to go to college because I just fell in love with it up here. And then pretty quickly, I fell in love with a guy. And then we got married and now we have kids and we're going to be empty nesters.
And you lived happily ever after.
I know. Well, we're not done, but yeah, it's looking like that's going to be the plan. So, so I never did go to college. However, I've always been really, I love learning, you know, so any format that I could learn before the internet came to be, which, you know, wasn't too long after high school, but, that kind of new mom period where the internet existed, but we didn't have it yet, you know, kind of a thing. I did a lot. I went to the library a lot. I looked at books and magazines. I would teach myself how to sew. You know, there were a lot of things that, you know, that I would do to figure out how to learn stuff. And I have since taken classes like at our college in a specific craft. But I'm kind of, you know, it's hard to say, oh, I'm glad I never did that or, you know, in a way it's because you don't know how things would have gone, but in a way I'm kind of glad I didn't pursue botany as a profession, because I mean, as much as I love it, I don't want to like do it all the time now, you know. and then also there's an element, I have a kind of a scrappy aspect to myself where I figure things out, and I've learned because I didn't go to college and I didn't have it all taught to me, which isn't to say that there's not a lot of hard work in figuring out in the college setting. I know there is, but it's like I had to get creative with how I learn stuff, you know, and that has become a muscle that I have that I rely on heavily. And I don't have that sort of idea that if I didn't learn it in college, then I can't learn it. You know, I'm like, well, I'm gonna learn it. Or am I going to figure it out? So, Yeah.
Well, I think all of that ties back to your background where you were given the freedom to just try, but they gave you a lot of tools and they gave you direction and then you were able to make it your own and then they gave you more direction and you kept going with it. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So I know you as a instructor of art. At what point were you making things where maybe you were letting other people see them, perhaps selling them, or when did it come to you that you could actually teach all these skills that you have?
Yeah, that's actually easier to answer than when did you start making art. That's much easier. My daughter, my first daughter, who's now 21, she was in diapers, and it was like a way to keep myself from going nuts, just changing diapers all the time.
Right.
And in our town, there was this local crafters market, you know, the kinds where everyone has booths, you know?
Yeah, those are the best.
I just remember there was this one that I loved. She was so good. She made stuff, but then she also, like, you know, sold little antiques and vintage things. And I just loved her booth. And one day I went in and she was there stocking. And you might as well have thought that I was meeting, like, the president of the United States or something. You know, somebody super famous. And because I was just like, oh, my gosh, that's her. And and I had the courage to, like, go and tell her, I love your booth. And she was so sweet and friendly.
Oh,
and
that's nice.
Yeah, then I started noticing that she was in more often. Anyway, we ended up striking a friendship, and turns out she was like, oh, you're crafty too? Why don't you come put stuff in my booth? So that's where it started. I started making stuff to sell in that booth with her, but it was all sorts of, it was anything that I was interested in. I sewed stuff, I refinished furniture. It was any old fun thing. And we kind of treated the booth as a display. So it was kind of like, oh, we've got all this stuff, but you know what we need? We need a dresser right here. So it was more like, you know, staging this scene, which was a fun kind of art form in itself.
I bet. And I'm thinking how many years ago that was, you know, nowadays everybody's competing with Pinterest and the staged booths. And I think you were probably ahead of the game there.
It was pre-Pinterest. It was pre-Instagram. Pre-social media. So as far as the closest we could have compared it to would be like a magazine. Like,
right.
Ooh, it looks like a magazine, you know?
Yeah.
Which people don't see anymore. Now they say it's Pinteresty, you know? So it's just like, or Instagrammy. So that
I don't
was
know.
Where
I
did
think,
that.
Yeah, I not to interrupt, but I think there's a lot of new magazines coming out now. I think we're having a second wave of magazines.
I agree. And the ones that are coming out are beautiful.
They are.
A lot less advertising than they used to have, which I think is pretty awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she introduced me to, she was so much more with it on the art scene. She introduced me to Claudine Hellmuth. This was a million years.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with Claudine's book, more just the idea that there was a market that would justify a book being made about what that is, like collage and, you know.
Yeah, mixed media.
Right. And so
right.
I didn't know that world existed out there, but the book was proof that it did. And so it was like, to me, fascinating. And I think I ended up finally finding her online, you know, and we had internet by then. And I took a workshop from her, Whidbey Island in Washington.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it was like such a big deal. And while I was there, there was a woman who, she wrote freelance for one of the craft and hobby magazines, and she liked what I had made in that class and said, hey, can I write an article about you? And I wasn't sure at the time if that was okay, but I asked Claudine, like, I made these in your class. What, you know, what's the deal? And it was totally fine. And one of the major art retreat organizers saw that article and said, I want you to come teach, you know, submit a proposal.
Oh, that's amazing. I love that.
What? It was super like, so I had no aspirations to be a teacher. I will say though that the teacher spirit is something that I have since come to discover I've always had. I've always had that, kind of, if I'm in a group with people, that's the role that I most comfortably take on in some form or another, you know.
I've actually never heard it described as that, but I really like that. I think I have that too. The teacher spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
I think you do too, the little bit that I know of you. I think so too. It's different than the know-it-all. It's different than the expert. It's different than any of that. It's being willing to share what you know because you see that it could be useful to somebody else.
Right.
Without thinking that you know more than somebody else. It's just that you recognize a difference or, you know, something that could be useful to somebody else. And on the backside of that, the satisfaction really comes in experiencing the other person receiving it with kind of like a new like now they have a little bit more expanded horizon.
Right.
You know, like now they know this new thing and now they're like, ooh, what else? You know, what else could I do with this? So yeah. I think that's a real big part of the satisfaction of having that teacher spirit. I don't think it can live in isolation, you know? So, I was too dumb to know how scary teaching would be. Like I had no clue. So I'm just like,
ignorance is bliss. All right.
Totally.
Yeah.
I had no idea how to submit a proposal. She was really sweet and told me, well, I just need this many pictures and this, you know, and I did. And she's like, awesome. Love it. So I taught and that was my first retreat.
What was the first class?
Well, I think I submitted three classes because it was a bigger retreat.
Okay.
One of them was kind of like an assembled shadow box thing and then some plaster work.
Okay.
So those were my very first classes. What's interesting is I was still dabbling in kind of jewelry and metalwork just for fun from my craft booth days.
Okay.
So that was still going on in the background, but it wasn't anything that it's really weird. I've worked really hard to try to remember when I shifted into doing metalsmithing publicly and started teaching it.
Right.
I don't remember. I just remember at one point it was another offering I threw out there.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the retreat where you did your first classes?
That was Art and Soul in Portland.
Okay. And that's when I met you. I took a jewelry class at Art and Soul in Portland.
Okay.
And it was some soldering. I want to say maybe that was
metal smithing.
Yeah. It was even before that. It was called we made the rings with a little copper rings with a little blob of solder that held the ring together.
Yeah.
And I forget what it was called. It was something else.
I can't remember either.
But that might have been 2005, I think. Does that sound right?
It could be. Probably 2006, but it could have been 2005.
Yeah,
actually,
not sure.
It could have been.
Yeah.
It's funny the things that we tie our memories to. Like, okay, what was I doing in 2005? That was the summer I had, you know, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, it would have been in that time frame. Yeah.
So when you did Art and Soul, and then you did Art and Soul the following year, correct?
Yeah, when I first started Art and Soul, I stayed with them for years. I did fall in Portland and spring in Virginia.
Oh, wow.
And then they would do these occasional satellite events, like Asilomar, California was one, Las Vegas was one. It was like that circuit that they were really, really good to me, not only the organizers, but the students. And like, it was just a really great run,
It was a good family of people. Did you?
Yeah.
So when you did Portland, you were driving there. How was your experience the first time you flew and you had to bring all of your supplies, your tools? How did you manage that? Was it another one of, I didn't know it was supposed to be hard, so I just did it.
It was very much that. And I also didn't know there were certain things you're not supposed to mail that I mailed to myself. So, you know what was my best friend at that time was Priority Flat Rate Shipping Boxes. I still love them. I would put all my torches. I would put a bazillion pounds of metal for the students, like kit metal. I put all this heavy stuff that I couldn't just go to the hardware store once I got there and buy.
Right. Make a heavy suitcase.
Right.
Right.
Right. Exactly. So I put it in boxes and ship it ahead of me. And, I was always just like sweating it. Like, am I getting this in the mail early enough? Cause I was so last minute, Lou.
Oh,
and,
gosh.
You know, I've never lost a package. I never had anything horrible happen. I've had, a couple things taken out of my suitcase here and there, but it was like, oh, no big deal. I put it in there knowing it might disappear like, chemicals or something,
Oh, right. Before they made the big liquid restrictions anyway.
That was the main thing what I do. But like with plaster, I almost just everything bought there. Like I would get somewhere and like if there's Lowe's or Home Depot, I can buy almost everything there.
Okay.
So I got that dialed in pretty well. My husband was like the best traveling companion when he would come with me. And he always came with me to Virginia. Like if I had to go a distance,
Across the country.
Distance. Yeah. Plus for the adventure, but also just to help me out. Cause I couldn't always, like in Virginia, for example, if I had to get to a hardware store, it was probably gonna be a 20-minute drive. So I couldn't just like, hey, you guys keep working. I'm going to run, grab some more plaster, you know, but I could send him and then it would just show up.
Amazing.
Right. It was awesome.
Husbands are wonderful.
It was amazing. So that was great. What the scariest experience was when I went to Australia. Scary, I mean, just nerve wracking was because they have different things there. You know, they had different, solders and different fluxes and things like that. And, you know, trying my best to describe for them, the hosts who are providing things, what we needed. And some stuff I shipped back up to myself there just in case. And in a couple situations I'm really glad I had, but mostly we just adjusted. And I kind of realized, well, I'm teaching to a group of amazing Australian women. And if this is what they can get, if this is what they can access, I want to help them learn how to do, you know, if this is the solder they have, if this is the flux they have, I want to help them use that. So at first I was like, I didn't like working with, I mean, their flux was greasy. I don't know. I just didn't like it, you know, but, it ended up being fine. You know, it was good. And I had a blast.
I bet. At what point did you go to Australia? Had you had a couple of years, a few years worth of teaching workshops under your belt at that point.
Yeah.
So you had that behind you.
I had proven myself, so to speak, you know, enough that the hosts were willing to foot the bill to get me there, you know, me there, take that risk. So yeah, it was, I can't remember what year. I should pull out my journals and see, cause I want to say it was probably 2008 or nine, maybe. I don't think it was 2010, but it was somewhere in that time frame. It was even earlier. Yeah, I shouldn't even guess because I can't remember. I had a few years of teaching under my belt by then. You know, enough to feel like I got it. I can do that, you know. So
That's great.
Yeah.
Did you continue to sell at craft shows and different events like that?
You know, I've never. When I really started teaching, I stopped doing the craft booth.
Okay.
I didn't find that I had access to any that were lucrative enough to feel like they were worth the effort.
Okay.
You know, and they're just a kind of different demographic shopping in a lot of ways. But I did do a couple of actual art shows in the Portland area. Mm-hmm. And those were awesome and great. And super stressful and, you know, all those kinds of things. But good experiences, you know,
yeah,
so
good.
Yeah.
During the time when you were first starting all these workshops and classes, were you selling things online, like maybe from Etsy or other sources?
Yeah. Yes. I did have an Etsy shop for forever. I think I still technically have it, but I never
think we all do.
I don't know. Who doesn't, right?
Right.
Because now I have my online website store.
Right.
Which is mostly what I sell from there are my courses and ebooks. I built it originally planning on selling original art through that.
Right.
But what I've found is like a million times easier and where more people are is actually just selling it straight off Instagram or Facebook.
Right. Or Facebook. That's what I've seen too. I have not tried to sell my things there, but people have huge success just saying, I'm putting it on Facebook. If you want it, put sold in the comment and there you go.
Yeah. I would say I've been doing that the last couple of years. And that's, I think that's exclusively how I've sold online, you know, is just posting it and saying, hey, if you want to claim it, you know.
Okay.
And it's worked fantastic. I mean, so easy. Boom, you put a picture up and it's done. You know, I don't have to log into my website and go to the back end and go to the, you know.
You put all these tags on it.
I am all for simple, you know, all for simple. Wherever things can be simple, because there are certain things that just aren't simple that you can't do anything about. And so where you can, do it.
And you've cut the middleman in terms of another site getting part of your income anyway.
Which a lot of people were really bothered by Etsy fees and whatnot. I was never bothered by that because it was like, I will gladly pay them 20 cents an item if they do the shopping cart and the shipping follow-up and the the storefront. Like, they did everything I didn't have the wherewithal to do. Yeah, I had to put my own stuff up there, obviously, but they created a space for people to come and buy it and find it and have the checkout process and all that kind of stuff. So I was never really bothered by paying a fee, you know, but it's fun not to now, you know. Sure. I still pay PayPal fees and that kind of stuff, but it's worth it. It's totally worth it to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Yeah, so you've seen a lot of changes in how people market their art over the years, starting with Etsy and other things. Yeah. Well, let me talk about social media for a second, because there's been a lot of changes in that. You know, in the 2009 area, time period, blog was the way to go. You know, you had to have a blog. You had to do 2 to 3 posts a week, and they had to be stories, lots of words. And now people, I guess our attention span has just gotten down to nothing. Don't write 4 paragraphs about a piece of jewelry you're trying to sell. You know, it's got to be quickie. Now you still have a blog. So how often are you posting on your blog? It must be very infrequent since you do Instagram and Facebook and.
Yeah, and if the listeners could see my face right now, they'd realize that I'm sitting here like, what? When did I last post?
Do I have a blog?
I do. I don't know when I last posted. That's how long it's been.
Yeah, I think it was Christmas of 2017. I looked it up.
Oh, my gosh. That's awful. Okay, well, so I post annually.
Yeah. But I don't think it's as important anymore, the blog format, the blog style.
Yeah. I agree. And somebody recently I heard on a different podcast that said the blog is dead. Here's why I don't agree with that. I can't even remember what it's called now, where you could, it like kept a list of all your blogs, you know, this website kept a list of all your blogs and it would show you when it was updated, you know, so you didn't have like.
Yeah. What was that called?
Google Reader. I don't know. Something like that. I can't remember what it was called, but it was like a feed. Capture, please.
So every single one that you followed, you would know when people were updating.
Yeah. I never had to go to their actual blogs. I just went to that list.
Yeah.
And so it was super easy for me to follow blogs, which means it was super easy for a lot of other people to follow blogs. I remember when that went away.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, what do I do now? And there was like this huge kerfuffle for a long time about what's your favorite? I can't remember what the term is of that thing, that site thing that it was. I feel so dumb right now, but.
No, I can't remember it either, but it was a way to quickly put comments on people's blog posts because it was all there. You weren't having to go through so many steps just to find their blog. And so you would just look through your feed, you'd read so-and-so's and you'd say, oh, that's so cool. Awesome. Send
it. It's exactly what Instagram is doing now, but it was with blogs, right? Yeah. Like, I'm going to follow these guys and then I'm just going to go to my timeline, my whatever, and follow them. So when that went away, it changed blogs, the engagement of blogs in a lot of different ways for the blogger, for the reader, for the whatever. So, I think that was when I stopped following blogs. I mean, like I was
following some.
And then I just could never like get it together again as a list. And I just kind of stopped following blogs. Mm-hmm. There are still some blogs I check in with now and then, but only by accident if they post about something and I come across it on a different social media platform that's like, hey, a new blog post is up. And then I'm like, oh yeah, you have a blog.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
and I think that some people have taken what is a blog, but they give it a different name on the tab on the menu for their website. So it might be called news. The latest news, stories, you know, down in Florida, we have art show circuits where in the winter, people are coming down and they're coming down in their RVs for months at a time because they're doing a show in West Palm Beach this weekend and the next weekend it's in Orlando and Sarasota and Tampa. And they'll use their blogs to put all their show dates and to say, here's where I'll be next. So it's not just a calendar. They're giving descriptions. They're giving all the dates of it. But they're going to call it show notes or something else.
Right.
And the word blog has such a stigma to it now that you can still do a blog, just gosh darn, call it something else. And then,
Well, and the thing, I think a lot of people believe that in order to be successful, you have to have a blog. And that's proving, I mean, there's a million reasons to, you know, why that's not true. And I don't think that blogging is necessary. I think if you are going to blog, I think it's a great tool. But I think if you are going to use it as a tool, you want to minimize how much of your energy that you're giving it, because it's not a huge driver of traffic.
Right.
And then you want to have it be really purposeful and intentional. So yes. I know people who blog daily, you know, and they have built such a loyal following, and they give so much, you know, I hate to throw the word value around because it's thrown around so much, but they give so much value of some form in their blog posts every time. Mm-hmm. And they're short enough that they're digestible on a daily level to where people stay engaged. It's like the morning paper, right?
Right.
You know, pop in the blog and check it out. But nowadays, that's what Insta stories is. That's what Facebook stories is. I don't think the blog has disappeared. I think it's just changed names and changed vehicle to get to us, you know, mm-hmm. ultimately. So when people say the blog is dead, yeah, I think it is for a lot of people, but I also think it's, if it's used well, it can be great. I think the problem is that a lot, as we get new social media platforms, a lot of people think they need to add that to their list of places to be visible.
Right. And it's just too many.
And not whittling away at their list.
Yeah. Yeah. But what's your feeling about websites?
Yeah.
I always think that everybody should have a website, because it's kind of a landing page that can summarize everything that you do. So if I just hear your name, if I walk through an art show and I see somebody's booth and I say, oh, her name was Jean Smith. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like to see a website that will then tell me she is on Instagram, she's on Facebook, she teaches classes, she sells right on the website, or she's sending you over to another market site. I like
yeah.
it as a landing page. But some people are really strong. They say, no, you don't even need a website. I agree that you certainly can do fine without one. It's just,
yeah.
for me, it's just, I prefer it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that depends so much on, how the artist is engaging on those other social media platforms.
Right.
So personally, I will always at least have a landing page as an artist.
Yeah.
I have a full on website right now, but it's really more website than necessary. It's, I'm not getting rid of any of it right now, but it's like you said, here, follow me here, follow me there. I mean, I don't think that it's necessary, but I do think that it's a really great, like you said, a place for people to find you, to then find out where else you are that they can follow you.
Right.
People won't follow you on a website. You know, they'll follow
right.
you on Instagram or Facebook or whatever social media platform that you engage on the most, you know? So, and in terms of social media, just, you know, just my kind of relationship with it there, I can handle about two platforms is about all I can handle.
Right.
And yeah. engage consistently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people that are on Snapchat and Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all this stuff, like, how do you guys do it all? I know you can repurpose stuff. You could shoot a Facebook live video and then you can share it on your Insta story and then you can email it to your people. Like, you can do one thing and share it in a lot of different ways, which I think is super smart and super energy efficient as an artist. But when people are engaging in platforms that require you to engage differently in each one,
yeah.
I'm like, I don't have it. I don't
yeah.
have it. I just don't have what it takes to do that.
And for me, I think it's kind of annoying when I follow someone's Facebook and I follow their Instagram and I see the exact same pictures in both places. They're just, or they have a Facebook and they have a personal Facebook page and a business Facebook page and their gallery page and their studio page. And I see the same thing five times.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a bit much.
Yeah. Well, when I post on Instagram, I almost always share it to Facebook. So it shows
yeah.
up in both places.
Yeah.
But to me, that's selfishly being efficient with my time.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because I have people on Instagram that are not on Facebook and I have people on Facebook
versa.
That are not on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be dumb for me if I'm marketing anything, if I'm, you know, putting a piece of art for sale up, it would be dumb for me to only post on one or the other.
Right.
Unless I'm just, you know, giving them a little special something, you know.
Yeah, right. Right. And then, you know, and that's true too. You do that occasionally. Yeah. Let me go back to talking about your teaching. So you started out teaching workshops that were not in your home or not in a studio right in your town where you live. They were far away, as far as Australia. But when did you start doing online courses? Because that's a big part of who you are right now.
Yeah, it's how you guys help me pay my light bill. So thank you.
There you go.
My online classes.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I'm so grateful for is the online world to be able to do that, because I literally would not have been able to continue teaching. My body starts giving out at like year 7 of hustle, you know, so to be able to do it online, you know, allows me to take care of my body, take care of my home and family, and still be able to teach that. So it's huge. Pros and cons to both, of course. Sure. I love them both for different reasons. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would ever do just one or the other unless there was something outside of my control that made it that way. My first online class was Homesteaders Metalsmithing, and it was in, it's funny, I just celebrated my 10-year bookiversary for Semi Precious Salvage Book. This year it came
out in 2008.
Thank you.
I'm sorry we didn't talk about that yet.
Oh, it's fine.
Say the title again.
Semi Precious Salvage.
Yeah. Wonderful
book. So thank you. That was what, having that published was like a huge boost in my teaching career. When that came out, I mean, I was already doing okay with the teaching before then, but when that came out, what was happening is I was able to teach at more venues and the classes were filling up faster. And so it was kind of like, wow, this is awesome. But it's also, you know, kind of what led to a little bit of burnout. Which I kind of hate using that term, because we all go through seasons. Just because I got tired, I mean, I necessarily burned out, but
you're
man, it was,
yeah,
it was tough. Yeah. So, I want to say it was, I can't remember if it was late 2008 or early 2009 when I first launched my very first online course, which was a spinoff of that book. It was all the things that I couldn't cover in the book, or it was some of the things in the book, but like expanded versions of it. And I didn't really have any models to look at. There were some, the online teaching space existed, but it was more academic and, you know, kind of different, just a whole different realm. There were a few creative classes, but a lot of them were hosted on really expensive platforms.
Yeah. And I remember when your metalsmithing course came out, I thought, how in the world is she going to do this? How do you teach it? Because I had taken jewelry courses live and soldering and different things. How is she going to teach all these tools and the techniques? But you did it. You pulled it off.
Yeah. Well, it was in my head for a good 6 months, because I had those same questions. Like, how am I going to do it? Because here's what happened when I was at the publisher for having my book published, mm-hmm. and they were photographing the process shots. The flame of the torch didn't show up on camera. They had to like Photoshop the flame in the book.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's all of the pictures. It might just be most of them, but I know that that was an issue.
Okay.
And so I just remember thinking, well, what if they don't show up on camera?
Right.
On video camera. And at some point, I remember I was at Art Fest, actually, in Port Townsend, Washington. I was kind of like just in my own head walking from one building to another or something. And it was like, well, I should just video it and see.
Right. Duh. Like, let's test
this. And the minute I had that thought, I was like, why did it take me? I think it was a few months. Like, why did it take me so long to even like, oh, well, let's try and see, you know?
I'm guessing back then you weren't taking video with an iPhone.
Well, no.
What were you using?
I was using a Canon, some sort of Canon video camera.
Okay.
That was
the other thing.
I think at the time I had to invest like $500 in this camera that now, I mean, you couldn't give away to somebody,
right.
You know?
Right.
Like the technology has evolved so much.
Yeah.
Hard.
I have to show you what I just grabbed.
Okay.
That's what I made in your class.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, look at that.
Oh. Okay, let me see that again. I want to see it with full attention.
So I'm in my art room, and I have kind of a shelf with all these things. Because I went to Portland Art and Soul like 4 or 5 years in a row. And so,
yeah,
so this is
I love that.
Yeah, this is a little bezel that where you cut a, you know, a piece of a copper pipe.
Yep.
And then you had this material where we could make little molds. We could put objects in it. And then this is just made out of solder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. Oh my gosh. I love that you still have it. That's so fun.
Yeah. I have shelves with, you know, the different things that I've made at classes over the years.
You're like shrine of creativity, huh?
Yeah. And for me, that was huge going to Portland, because in Florida, there was nothing. And I was reading magazines like Rubber Stamp Madness, you know, back in the day. And it was all Oregon, Washington, California. And there was just nothing on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but my brother lives in Portland. And I realized, I can go to Portland much cheaper than Virginia Art and Soul because I can stay with him and I borrow his car and I didn't get a hotel or a rental car or anything. So
right.
Was, yeah.
Just so your airfare.
I just did that for, I did it like 4 or 5 years in a row. It was great.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Portland in the fall is pretty sweet too.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, when you left the hotel, you went around this big, the big interstate highways, the on ramps, and twirl around and you go around. And so it was like the third or fourth day. I'm leaving at, 7 o'clock at night and you go around and at one point you're facing Mount Rainier. And it was the, or maybe it was Mount Hood. I forget which one. But anyway, it was the first day.
It'd be Mount Hood.
Mount Hood. That's what it was. It was the first day. It was not cloudy. And I do this highway and suddenly there was a mountain in front of me that I hadn't seen all week.
Oh my gosh.
From?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a pretty significant mountain.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny.
So we were talking about how you first started doing the videos. You were talking about the camera, the $500 camera you just bought.
Yeah.
That's how you said, okay, well, let me test out videotaping this. And that led to online class.
Yeah. So we invested in that camera. It was kind of a scary investment at the time for us. And we just started doing it. My husband manned the camera. Like, he was my videographer. And so he'd like move it around and get angle shots. And part of me is, I kind of miss those days because he could get right up close to something and change the angle. Whereas nowadays I shoot most of my camera, above my head just because I can't wait for him to be home all the time for me to, do classes. I'm shooting a bunch of video today, in fact, So
darn you, husband, having another life and you can't help me all the time.
Rude. I know. So, it's what's really funny is that so he's a contractor and I love him to pieces. We have so much fun together. I hate working with him because he's like expects me to read his mind and all that kind of stuff. But when he was working for me, it was awesome. It was awesome. We had a lot of fun and he would do stupid antics on camera and then we'd have to do another take, and it was really fun. But that was what I was saying is that the few creative courses that I had seen at that time were on expensive platforms. And I just, I couldn't afford it. It was intimidating. I just but I had a Typepad blog and I learned how to make a password protected page on my Typepad blog. And so I hosted all of them on my blog. I knew that I wasn't protecting them 1,000%. I wasn't protecting my content 1,000%. People could share the password. There were issues, but I also knew that I had to just do my best and let it go or else I was never going to create it. I was never going to put it out there.
Right. Okay.
So I did that. So for years, that's where my online courses lived, was on my blog.
Okay. Yeah. And one of the courses that I took from you, and it was 2010, was Thought Threads. And it was all about journaling.
Yeah.
I loved that course.
Thank you.
And what was cool, it was a fabulous course, so there's that. But what was cool to me was I knew you as a jewelry artist, and then I saw what you were doing with plaster and different things. And then here she's doing a course on journaling, on writing your thoughts. But that impressed me so much that you said, I've mastered I know how to do a class on my Typepad blog, and it can be any subject that I feel passionate about, and I'm going to do it. And I love that.
Thank you. Yeah. And journaling is very near and dear to my heart. It's my first love before any of the art. So to share that in that way was fun. And, I've learned a lot since then. So what's really funny that you mentioned that, because I've actually been, I've started an idea journal for reviving something along those lines again and doing it again. So we'll see what happens now that I know more. We're smarter every year, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were saying that you were doing all of these classes on your Typepad blog. So you were the host for all of these classes, but I see now when you go to your website, you're doing some that you can buy right from your shop on your website, but then others you're using another platform such as GeneOliver.com. Is that what it is? GeneOliver.com?
Yes.
So what is the reason you how did that happen that you went and you started hosting or using other people to host your classes? And what's the benefits or, you know, what can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so I believe that's just totally a personal preference. Some people won't do it and they have valid reasons not to.
Okay.
And I have sort of a rules, you know, personal set of rules of that will determine whether I do it or not for somebody else. Mm-hmm. Most of my courses are my own on my website. All of my original online courses are now ebooks. The only courses I have now where you have to go to my website and like log into a page are my mini courses.
Okay.
So those are, you know, those are the ones I've been doing since October of last year. There should be 9 of them now. Well, there will be 9 by the time June is over. The last one's in the works. I'm taking a break from those just because I'm hammered with summer stuff and, moving my daughter to college and things like that. So
let me just back up a little bit for those mini classes, just so people listening know what a mini class is. About what is the time commitment for someone taking it and how much does a class, what like the range do, would those classes cost?
So all of my mini courses are $15, $14.95. Okay. And I've been reamed up one side and down the other for charging not enough. I've been told I should give that away for free. I've heard every opinion under the sun about those classes. That's a price that feels good to me. It was also kind of an experiment for me because a lot of my courses before were, you know, a lot more expensive. And even then, with as much as I poured into them, really affordable for the content that was in them. But I really wanted to experiment with something for the sweet, sweet people that I had met over the years that wanted to do more art, but just felt like, I mean, the going rate for an online course is like $100.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, you know? And they're worth it. They're great. But what if you can't afford that? You know, what if you're on fixed income or what if you, you know, who knows? And so I thought, you know, I don't necessarily want my clientele to be people who can't afford my work. You know, it doesn't work for any of us.
Right.
At the same time, I don't want a high-priced class to keep someone from exploring their creativity. That just doesn't sit right with me. So, but they still take a lot of time and energy on my part. So giving them away for free didn't feel right either. So, they're $15 and they're a 1 to 2 hour time commitment. And the idea is, you know, from beginning to end, most of them are, I think they're all project based, you know, so from beginning to end of a project. So, and they've been so much fun to do.
I bet. I think that's great. And I think you've probably made a lot of people happy.
I hope.
Yeah.
Well, I've received a lot of good feedback and I've loved seeing what people have made in those classes, you know, or as they've followed along.
Yeah.
The rest of my courses, they're much longer time commitments. So like Homesteaders Metalsmithing, my very first one, for example, it was a month long course and I, you know, there was content every day.
Every course I've taken from you, you have just exploded on us with content. And so what you get your money's worth. You do. I didn't mean that
I'm
in
so
a negative
glad you
way.
Feel that way. No, I know.
Yeah.
I'm glad you feel that way because that's the experience I want participants to have.
Mm-hmm.
Is that there's a lot. There's a fine line between, you know, overwhelming and giving a lot. And I've just really kind of turned it over to the participants' discernment to know what's overwhelming and what's not. Like, I'm going to give you everything you've got, pick and choose what you want to play with, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't want to babysit that aspect because for another person, it might not be enough, you know? So I have to do what feels good and right to me and then let everybody kind of grab what, you know, what feels good to them out of it. Those are all, those bigger courses are all ebooks now, which is cool because you can download it and you have it and you can revisit it and you can
leisure. Yeah.
Totally leisure at your, you know, as many times as you want. And that works great. What caused me to decide to submit content to other people's platforms? You know, that was a little risky because it's like, well, shoot, I'm going to all trouble to make this class and I'm not going to be able to control the money. And, you know, I don't know. It's just like, I'm sharing my percentage, but I thought, well, I'm going to try it once and see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awesome. I made the content and I didn't have to do the page build. I didn't have to do, you know, any of that kind of stuff.
Oh, nice.
I was able to reach a much wider, larger audience than just what I could reach myself.
Mm-hmm.
So There are some people that I probably wouldn't ever partner with, not because there's anything wrong with them, but just because of the what they require from me or okay. what their reach is or something just doesn't quite, you know, just doesn't quite math out for me. But Jean's site is awesome. They've just built a whole new site that's beautiful and a million times easier for engaging in than, you know, they had an older site before that worked great. But, mm-hmm. you know, picking collaborative partners to work with has so much for me also to do with the people that I'm collaborating with. You know, just.
That makes sense.
I don't want to partner with someone who's mean, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. How had you heard of her? Had you taken one of her classes or you talked to somebody else who had classes on her site?
I think I read her blog back in the blog days, and but that was before she was teaching. She was, any of that. I've actually never taken one of her classes personally. She and I have, you know, we're engaged as friends, and so I've gotten an inside look at stuff, you know, but okay. I haven't officially taken a class of hers. And then we both were invited to teach together on Bainbridge Island a few years back. Like I taught one day to this group and then she taught another day to the same group.
Oh, fun.
And the gal that invited us knew both of our work and put us together and said, this is a really great fit. And we knew each other before then, but that's where we like really clicked as like,
yeah,
you know,
you made a connection.
Yeah. That's great.
So. Okay. There was one other class that I saw on your website that I wanted to ask you about because I didn't know quite what it was. What is Wanderlust?
Oh, that's coming up. Check it out. So that's another collaborative thing. It's a gal over in the UK, I believe. Her name is, I'm scared to say her name because I'm probably going to say it wrong. Cassia Avery. I could be saying it wrong. You know, okay. I see it a million times. So it's a cool thing. A few people are doing that. I have one starting actually next month also from with a gal in Australia called Online Creative Retreat from the artismagic.com. So those are where somebody is hosting a virtual retreat.
Okay.
So instead of me lugging all my stuff to a hotel in Portland with 20 other instructors,
right.
I'm set submitting online content and it's like you as a participant, you sign up for this virtual retreat and you get to experience multiple classes from different instructors from the comfort of your pajamas.
Nice. That sounds great. What is the deadline for signing up for that? Or when does it begin?
They're still open. They're still open.
Okay.
Yeah. They both, I should have had that in front of me. They both launch in July, I believe. And one of them is you get an aspect of it for free. And then if you want to, get even more content, it's a, you know, an upgrade fee, which is totally worth it. And, you know, the costs are just so minimal for what you get out of it, you know, so both of them can still be registered for.
Okay.
Wanderlust and
what was the other one called?
Go to art. Well, they're both on my website. There's two names for it. So it's produced by Art is Magic and it's called, I think it's just called Creative Retreat Online.
Okay.
I could be messing that up.
No, I'll put all this information on the show notes, which is what I call my blog. My blog is called Show Notes now.
Smart.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'm just going to go through my notes real quick and see if there's anything else I wanted to talk about. Oh, I also wanted to ask you about the Wholehearted Artist. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, okay. So the Wholehearted Artist was probably the most difficult course for me to birth. But I felt like it was one of the most important ones I've birthed up till this point because it has so much to do with the journey as a creative person within the context of competition, selling your work, being public about it, how to maintain, you know, this authenticity that people strive for. And it's really challenging even talking about it because some of these words that I'm using even now have been so used. It's like kind of we're getting to eye roll status of like, oh my gosh, if one more person tells me about being authentic, I'm going to gag. But that's the reality is that there's so much striving to be seen or striving to be recognized or even not those things, but striving to feel really at peace with what you're doing because it feels authentic.
Yes.
That it's really hard to kind of sometimes pull on that thread of trueness in you that knows how to navigate some of these challenges that you know all creatives are faced with at this point. And right. and it's not some of the common topics of just like, it's like, okay, we talk about self-care, but not just like, hey, burn a candle and take a bath, that's self-care. It's like, we really get into the nitty-gritty of what that means on a level of taking responsibility for things, what that means on a level of commitments, what that means, even to our own craft, you know?
Okay.
So it deals with what I've discovered in my journey, my personal journey, is I broke it down into 12, which is a ton still,
right?
But to 12 areas of life that I have discovered these areas don't seem to have anything to do with your art or your craft. But if any one of these is really out of whack, it's going to affect your ability to show up in the making space, you know, and to be able to trust the process, to be able to be fully present and to be able to create work that's unique for you. And that includes how we're caring for our bodies, what kind of friendships we have or don't have,
okay.
how we relate to money. So it's like, it's the idea that we can't just become happier artists by trying to be happier artists. We have to look at the other aspects of our life and say, where here am I not engaging fully with my whole heart, that if I do, it will improve the way my art, you know, comes out.
It sounds huge to me. Did you take a really long time formulating this course?
Yeah. Well, have you ever heard that kind of like, it's kind of like a little joke where someone says, like, to an artist, how long did it take you to make that? And the artist says 40 years.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like
right.
that. It's like, that only took you 10 minutes to make. No, it took me 40 years because
yeah.
that's how the wholehearted artist was for me. It took months to actually like organize the content and write the content.
Yeah.
But the experiences that created that content, you know, it's like my whole life. Right.
right? Okay.
But some of it specifically, what was so important to me was recognizing how many times I would hear the same topic. You know, someone's struggling with the same topic. And I start to notice like, oh, there's another person really struggling with that. Holy cow. There's like 50 people that are really having a hard time with this aspect of creativity. And so am I. Okay. I'm not the only one. What are we going to do about it? What, you know, what kind of conversations do we need to have? Because clearly the conversations that are being had aren't fixing it.
Right.
You know,
we're still talking about it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there comes a point where, okay, let's do our best to assess what's not working and make some adjustments as needed. And that's so individualized. You know, are you sleeping enough? Which sounds like like nobody wants to be told you need more rest because no, I'm trying to get more done, you know, kind
right.
of a thing.
Yeah.
But the reality is if you're taking an honest look at the ways that sufficiency in your life is lacking,
mm-hmm.
Sufficiency of space, of health, of support, encouragement, all those kinds of things. Why do we think that we can then make amazing, incredible, beautiful, powerful art if we're kind of living an anemic life in other ways, you know? And everything might be great, but there just might be still some room for improvement. So it's not like, hey, if your life sucks, come take this
right.
course. It's like,
yeah.
hey, if you're alive, come take this course because there's stuff to look at it for everybody.
Okay.
So it's geared specifically towards artists of some form, but I, you know, my experiences aren't just as an artist. So there's definitely stuff in there, you know,
yeah.
just whole living stuff.
When did you launch this?
2016, I believe, or maybe it was 2007. Oh my gosh. Why do I have such a hard time with dates? I want to say it was spring.
So it was an e-course, and is it an e-book now or is it still an e-course?
Yeah.
It's an ebook now.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. And I'm actually considering, I've got a lot of ideas in my journals right now and I'm kind of still discerning which ones to actually do and whatnot. I'm considering making a group around that, a Facebook group around that, because I know that that's an ongoing conversation in terms of like, okay, I got this when I took the course, but now I'm still struggling with it. Why? You know,
okay.
like let's talk about that. So,
right.
I'm feeling like I want to revive that in some form here coming up soon. But for now, it's a download. Like, you can access it right now and go through the 12 lessons at your own pace. And yeah.
That's great. That's great. Well, good, good. You go in so many different directions, but they all seem to be linked. You know, I mean, everything is so true to you, and you couldn't get to this point of doing this one thing if you hadn't done these thousand things beforehand.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird too. I felt a lot of people. So my experience as an artist was interesting in that there would be times where I'd be like, I'd post art, and somebody would know me for that art.
Yeah.
And then I would post that I was making jam at home or something, you know, and I'd get these odd comments like, oh, I didn't know you knew how to do that. Like, well, I do a lot of things in my life besides
right, that you don't know about.
Yeah. But and that's not the problem. The problem is when I was witnessing other people experiencing that and then them feeling like they either can't share these other things that they're doing because it confuses people, or they can't do them because it confuses people. And it's like, your life is bigger than what comes out of your studio.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And everything that doesn't happen in your studio affects what happens in your studio. So let's try to get this connection going to where you feel at peace with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you've accomplished that.
It's an ongoing journey for all of us,
Yes, of course. Of course. Yeah. So thank you very much, Stephanie. That was great. Thank you for sharing with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciated it.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Left Brain Artist Podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing Stephanie Lee talk about her art and her business. We didn't laugh too much, did we? Here are some takeaways from this episode. This is one of my favorite quotes from our conversation. She says, "I have the teacher spirit, which is being willing to share what you know because you think it will be useful to someone else without thinking that you know more than somebody else." Isn't that wonderful? Number two, she doesn't use Etsy or her website anymore to sell artwork. She's had good success just posting items on Instagram and Facebook. Number three, people still want to hear stories from artists. They're just not on blogs. She utilizes the Instagram stories feature. Number four, don't spend a lot of time on something if it's not profitable. It's a good thing to analyze this about so many things that you do. Number five, she can handle about two platforms on social media and engage consistently. There's no reason to force yourself to do too many. Number six, when her book came out, she was able to teach at more venues and the classes filled up faster. Number seven, she chose to offer mini courses for $15 so they would be affordable and can cover an art topic. Number eight, and finally, do your best and get going, or else you're never going to create it. I think those are good words to live by. Thank you for listening to the Left Brain Artist Podcast. On Friday, I'll talk a little bit more about destination art classes in my bonus business episode, so be sure to check that out. I've loved the traveling I've done to take art classes, and I'll give you lots of links in the show notes so you can find some too. I'm Suzanne Redman. See you next time.